Coming up on Philosophy Talk, how does culture shape our ways of thinking and acting?
I'll see what you've done with your filthy Eastern ways.
Are Western ways of thinking and acting fundamentally different from Eastern ways?
How do we know you're not just as filthy when you've lulled us with your filthy Eastern ways?
Do Western and Eastern cultures construe the self differently?
You're all individuals!
Yes, we're all individuals!
You're all different!
Yes, we are all different!
I'm not.
Is there a culturally transcendent, universal notion of the self?
Or is the very idea of self culturally bound and culturally variable?
Our guest is noted cultural psychologist Hazel Marcus.
Culture, self, and action. Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, different cultures, different selves.
We're going to discuss the idea that forms the basis of what's called cultural psychology. The idea that people in different cultures have different selves. Frankly, Ken, I find that idea a bit obscure.
John, that surprises me. You've written so much about personal identity and the self yourself. I'd expect you'd have a clear vision of what cultural psychologists are talking about. They have lots of data, cool data, that showing, for example, that Asian selves and American selves are quite different. So what's your problem?
Well, I don't know if I can't see the forest because I'm staring at the trees, or I can't see the trees because I'm staring at the forest. But I'll tell you what we can do, Ken. I'll make some distinctions that I've found useful in thinking about the self, and then you can use my vocabulary to explain to me what in the world cultural psychologists are driving at.
Okay, that sounds like a plan. Let's go.
All right, for starters, what is a self? I have a very simple view. My view is a self is just a person, a human being with the normal capacities of thought, memory, reason, and the like. The phrase myself is like the phrase my neighbor. My neighbor is just an ordinary person, thought of as the person who lives next to me. Suppose I say, Obama doesn't like drama kings or queens and expects everyone in his office, his secretary, his national security advisor, and himself to remain cool and rational. When I say himself, I'm just referring to Obama by the relation he has to the person I'm talking about, namely identity. Nothing mysterious about the self.
John, I have to say that's a remarkably thin theory of what selves are. And it's rather unphilosophical. You surprise me. I mean, philosophers think of the self as some sort of inner principle of some sort, don't they? I mean, don't we? Be true to yourself, we say. You think that's all nonsense?
Well, no, but I think it's much better thought of as talk about our concepts of ourselves. We each have a very important concept or idea, the one we express with the word I. It's the way we think of ourselves, the people we are. It's where we store all the information we get in these special ways, like when we know what we're thinking and we know our reasons for doing things. My concept of myself has a quite special structure, different from my concept of even my closest friends, like you. But it seems to me, in this respect, it's going to be the same with Japanese and Chinese and, to take an extreme case, people like you from Ohio.
Well, John, okay, then I would say, using your vocabulary, here's what I'd say to you. Cultural psychologists are thinking about the structure of those special concepts we each have of ourselves. And they think that those structures vary in interesting ways across cultures. Can't you buy into that idea?
Well, in theory, it makes sense. But I'm still skeptical. It seems to me that we all have ideas of ourselves with a very similar structure, a universal structure. For example, we all think that we have bodies that we can control in ways that no one else can, just by deciding and willing what to do. We all think that we have special ways, our senses, of finding out what's going on around those bodies. Am I to believe that people in other cultures don't share this basic structure in thinking about themselves?
No, nobody's asking you to believe that, but I do think you're seeing a few philosophical trees and missing a vast psychological forest.
Tell me more, oh deep thinker.
Well, consider, first of all, the things that we find most important about ourselves, the ways we can't even imagine being different. I mean, you're from Nebraska. Don't you see that as an important, even essential characteristic of yourself?
No. I was thinking of myself as not being in Nebraska from the day I was old enough to think. I left Nebraska when I was young, almost at the first opportunity. It didn't change me in any significant way. It just put me, the real me, in a different situation with different opportunities to express myself.
John, that's a pretty common attitude for Americans. We pick up and move at the drop of a hat. But cultural psychologists will tell you that that's pretty unusual. Far more common, especially, say, in Asia, is that who one is, one's self-concept in your vocabulary, is rooted in one's home, one's family, one's ancestors. Moving across a country or across the world, that's hard to imagine. And people have done it. Lots of people have done it. But it's always been traumatic. In a way.
Well, I have a friend, Chun Tsutsuya, who lives in Tokyo, and maybe you have a point. He commutes 3 hours every day across the whole of Tokyo to his job. He won't move closer to the university where he works, even though the housing is less expensive there, because that would mean moving away from his father and his mother and his brothers, all of whom live in a neighborhood where his family has lived for generations. I've always thought that was completely weird.
But John, you're just spouting the American individualism. But that's a cultural bound way of thinking about the self, and that's no more valid than other ways of thinking about the self.
Oh, I think it's completely valid. It's my duty to share it with the rest of the world. But anyway, to help us sort this out, we've got Hazel Marcus, a cultural psychologist from Stanford, who will be joining us in a minute.
And so will our listeners. And the number to call is 1-800...
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Nancy Mullane, looks into the issue of the self and others. She files this report.
We've all seen it, or maybe even done it. You know, caring for someone when they need help. Lending money, letting a friend sleep on the couch, maybe just giving someone a ride. But what if it means self-sacrifice? What's the stronger motivation, self-interest or social concern and sympathy?
Well, I mean, there's people on both sides of the spectrum. And I think more so people do stuff for themselves.
Well, I'm a social worker, and I think human beings are really connected people, and that as a human, I would hope that somebody would help me when I was in need. And because of that, I'm also always helping other people. It's sort of like building the social capital between the people too. So
the reason I do those type of things is because I think of how I would feel if I was in that person's position.
There's something probably biological that we could point to that ultimately drives people to do what they do rather than some sort of moral drive, you know?
So what does motivate people to care about others? Are there biological explanations?
One is the deep evolutionary answer that has to do with the origins of human goodness.
Dacher Keltner is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and author of the book Born to be Good.
We are an ultra-social species, and we had this great selection pressure, which is to take care of profoundly vulnerable offspring. And what that built into us is an instinct to care.
In addition to an instinct to care about others, scientists have found there's a physiological basis for compassion. Keltner says these scientists have discovered that there are regions in our brains that help us respond to the suffering of others.
We have these emotions like compassion and empathy that involve specific patterns of neural activity in the brain, specific regions of our nervous system, and those emotional reactions are proximal causes of altruistic behavior, of volunteering, of sacrifice in romantic relationships, of caretaking in communities.
Not only does that brain-to-nerve stimulus create positive social behavior, Keltner says at the neurological level, it triggers the release of dopamine, which brings about feelings of warmth, calmness, and intimacy, a kind of payoff.
So at the level of the brain, when I give, I derive a secondary pleasure, which is pretty remarkable. The brain is saying, this is pleasurable to sacrifice for you.
So if we're naturally hardwired to care about others, what role does nurture play in making people more socially sympathetic?
It begins with this appreciation that all humans suffer and that suffering is part of life. And the minute that you start to realize that people close to you suffer, they die, they suffer disease, they suffer economic hardship, that suddenly turns on this empathy switch or compassion switch and makes you more altruistic.
According to Keltner, new data shows compassion is the key to a long, healthy marriage, helps you beat certain diseases, and makes you live a long life. Our current economic crisis offers a historic opportunity to redefine our values.
I hope this crisis reorients us away from this self-interested model of human nature, which is part of who we are, but it's been privileged the past 25 years, to caring and compassion, which are also part of our human nature, but have been underdeveloped as a culture.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Nancy Mullane.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Hazel Marcus. She's professor of psychology from Stanford University, editor of Engaging Cultural Differences, The Multicultural Challenge to Liberal Democracies. Hazel, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Hi, Hazel. Give us a brief account, if you would, of how you became interested in this interesting topic of cultural psychology and the differences about how among people around the world and how they conceive of themselves.
It began when I was at the University of Michigan. The University of Michigan had a long-time relationship with a couple of universities in Japan, and often I had the opportunity to lecture and talk. And I lectured and talked, and I found that people listened to me politely when I talked about self-esteem and self-concept, but I never got any questions, and I didn't get much response. And finally, when many Japanese students began to come to graduate school, and I got to know some of them, they started to tell me, you know, your ideas about the self make absolutely no sense. I was shocked. No one had bothered to tell me this. And then when we started to form some good relationships, I began to understand that this big question of what is the self, it's the universal question. Everyone answers it, but there are very, very different solutions, answers.
Now your work has focused on Asian selves and American or Western selves.
Right.
Briefly, what are the biggest differences and what kind of data leads you to these conclusions?
Well, in the field of cultural psychology, it's very important that we start with a quick definition of what culture is. People often tend to think of culture as something that's inside people, so that the idea that Americans have American values, beliefs, motives, American bits, or say maybe Japanese have Japanese bits, Japanese ideas, motives, values. But it's very important when we're talking culture from a sociocultural, psychological point of view, we are not talking about locating culture inside the head. We're very importantly talking about locating culture outside in the world. It's in those ideas, in those practices that are in the world that we have to engage with to become people. So the idea is you cannot be a self by yourself. You must engage with
the world.
Okay,
so there's all this cultural stuff out there that we interact with.
Right.
And I assume by interacting with it, we form self-conceptions of various kinds. Okay, but what's the biggest difference between give me the nutshell version,
right,
and then we'll talk in more detail later. The nutshell version of the biggest difference between Americans and Japanese, say.
Very simple. The biggest difference is that in American context, we tend to think about the self as a bounded, autonomous entity, and we tend to think that that self is made up of a set of attributes, and we give those attributes names like attitudes, beliefs, goals, motives, preferences, and it's the expression of those internal bits that creates behavior, that drives behavior.
Okay.
In East Asian context, very different answer to what is the self. Instead, people see the self, understand the self, feel the self as made up of relationships. You are the first fact, the beginning fact, is that you are born into and are always into a net of relationships. You are a node in those relationships. And so being a self, being a person, always takes into account others, your connections with others, their expectations for you, the obligations that you have to them, and being is about adjusting to those, taking those others into account necessarily. It's relationships.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing different cultures, different selves, with noted cultural psychologist Hazel Marcus.
America is a land of immigrants. Are you an immigrant or the child of immigrants? Do you see differences in the way you or your parents think about the self and the way the average American does? Share your ideas and experiences with us. You can join us by calling 1-800.
You're hearing an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
9917.
Different cultures, different selves, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
No, we're not turning Japanese, but we are looking at different cultures and the way they see themselves. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk. How do you think of yourself? As an autonomous individual, the product of the unique values and beliefs you've developed on the basis of your own experiences? Or do you see yourself as part of something larger, a system of shared values, goals, commitments, and ways of looking at the world, rooted in your family and friends and ancient traditions? How do you deal with people who would give a different answer to that very question? The number is 1-800-525.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or, as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Hazel Marcus from Stanford University. She's the editor of a big book on these topics with a big title, Engaging Cultural Differences, The Multicultural Challenge in Liberal Democracies.
So, Hazel, you talked a little bit about the big way in which Japanese, I think we were referring to, and Americans differ in their conceptions of themselves. The Japanese think of themselves as interdependent. We think of ourselves as autonomous and independent. So, okay, I want to know more about why you think that in a bit, but let me, for one thing, do these different ways of thinking have any real implications, any real-world implications for how Japanese versus Americans behave and relate to others? I mean, tell us some of the consequences of this.
They have absolutely powerful consequences. They are self-shaping. They influence how you think, how you feel, how you act. They're just not attitudes and beliefs. And, of course, because people are culturally shaped shapers of their world, the way they are thinking or feeling, they put those ideas into their world and they build their world as a result of these ideas. So it's enormously consequential.
Well, it's enormously consequential, but, I mean, come on, aren't they just wrong? I mean, look, I'm a physically bounded being. I have skin, and things get under that skin and into my brain in all sorts of ways, from my ancestors, my parents, and other people. But what I do depends on what goes on in that brain. I'm an individual.
Well,
I mean,
that's absolutely partly.
He's suggesting you can't escape the separateness of each self.
No, absolutely not. And of course, we are biological beings. Our genes, our proteins, our neurons, our hormones, our brains are critical for understanding our behavior. And there, as we know, a great deal of exciting research that's showing how the biological structures behavior. But that is only half of the story. One that's at least as important, I would say more important, is that we are also sociocultural beings. And so our cultural contexts are critical for understanding our behavior. They provide the structure for our behavior. We haven't studied them as much. It's not as easy to scan them as we can the brain, but they are like water to the fish. They're sort of not available.
Okay, I want you to tell. Give me
very powerful.
I want you to make this a little more concrete
yes.
for me. I'm a Japanese person. I'm an American person. Okay. I have some life decision to make. I have some choice to make. I have something to do. Show me how the difference in the way I conceive of myself as autonomous and independent or interdependent. How does that affect how I?
I'll show you how it affects. Let me start with an example of a small study that some of my colleagues have done with 8-year-old children. And what they did was to take kids who had Asian American background or kids who had European American background, and they gave them a task of chance to work on some puzzles. And these puzzles involved unscrambling some words. And before doing that, they gave the kids a choice. They said, do you want to work on puzzles about the beach or the park or the zoo? And then there was another condition in which they said, you know, last week when your mom was at school, we asked her about what kinds of puzzles you liked, what kinds of games you liked, and she said you would like to work on puzzles about the zoo. So there were these two kinds of conditions, and the experimenters looked at how well the children did, how many problems they solved correctly, depending on what condition they were in. And they compared the kids with East Asian background and kids with European American background. And what they found is that, as American educators would suggest, when the kids got to choose which kind of puzzle they wanted to work on, they actually solved the most puzzles. They performed better. That was the European American kids. However, the kids with Asian American background, in the condition in which they solved the ones their mother said was best, when another chose for them, they solved the most. In fact, they did dramatically better. So you might think, well, oh, what is this? You know, don't Asian kids or kids with Asian background like to have choice? They like to have their choice taken away from them? What's the matter with them? But you see, what it is when somebody who is so important to you, you are in relationship with the mother, when that person has some information for you, tells you something would be good for you, you don't reject right. it of someone trying to cramp your style. You take that in. That's important to consider that person, because after all, you are in relationship with that person and always will be.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about different cultures, different selves, with noted cultural psychologist Hazel Marcus. We'd love to have you join this conversation. 1-800-525-9900.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or, as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've got a caller on the line now, Roshanada in San Francisco. Did I get that? Did I butcher that name?
No, that's pretty good.
Okay, so what's your comment or question, Roshanada?
Well, this subject really hits home to me, and it's, you're putting words to things that I've been struggling and thinking about for many years. I grew up in I guess you could call it a bicultural family. My mother's American and my dad's a Pakistani Muslim, and I, you know, 7 days a week, I grew up running around the street playing with my American friends, but I also experienced a very different culture in the home, and it really affected my sense of self, and I saw that as a young adult and as an older parent myself now, how I develop my children's self-esteem, so to speak, and, you know, did my foreign or my, you know, my other cultured parent do that in a way that helped me to fit in with other American kids. So I remember my dad remarried another Pakistani, and the, you know, we were having sort of, you know, stepmother stepdaughter relationship issues, and I complained about it to my mother, who's very American, you know, whatever that means, and she said, oh, well, you should tell her this and you should tell her to stop doing that. And I said, I can't say that to her. And I thought about it for years, and the reason is because I knew that I was a part of this important relationship, even though I was an independent adult when they remarried, and she, you know, and I didn't have much to do with each other, but I knew that I couldn't say the things that, you know, maybe would have been okay to say to an American stepmother. They were terrible things, but they were sort of like, you know, I'm a grown-up, you know, shouldn't tell me how to,
It's a fascinating case study, Roshanada.
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 Thanks. Hazel, what do you want to respond to there?
Oh, it's exactly what so many people experience. And before they understand that there are multiple models, multiple ways of being a self, it can really be very crazy-making for people. Once you see that there are a number of answers to what is a self and what is the right way to be in the world and what's good and true and right and real and rational, it sort of helps you. You can see, you can use these as resources. But it's once you know it is one thing, actually how to work it out in your life is another. And it's a common struggle, because when you have the idea of the self as relational, you do not want to do anything that breaks those bonds. That's the worst thing.
Right, I understand that, but the rationale, she was in a complicated situation. Her it sounded like one of her parents, her father, I think, was an immigrant.
Right.
So she's, what do you call that, first generation, second generation? I'm not quite sure how you count the generations. And she's growing up in two worlds. She's kind of bicultural.
Growing up in two worlds.
How do you, what's your research say about these bicultural people? Is she just betwixt and between? Does she have an incoherent self-conception?
No.
Does she trade off Monday this, Tuesday that?
Once you understand that there are these multiple ways of being, you can see them as having more resources. And so what you have to do is figure out what the situation is, and you can use one set of models at work, for example, or at school. We find find that our students at school, at work, they act as independent, autonomous selves. When they're at home with their family, they can do the interdependent model. So
it's like being bilingual in a way.
To some extent, you can do some kind of code switching once you understand there are those models there. But it's you can't just put them on and off like a sweater or a jacket. I mean, some of them, whichever one gets in there first, tends to have a bigger effect.
1-800-525-9.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
About different cultures, different selves, with noted cultural psychologist Hazel Marcus. And we've got Joseph in San Francisco on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Joseph.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to point out the fact that, as John Mbidi says in his book called African Philosophy, the African experience and the African-American experience is such that his words are, I am because we are because I am. And in the social context of being an African-American in America, you always have this bicultural stance, and because of the oppression that happened during the course of our experience in America, it is absolutely the fact that it is family first and relationships first that really set up our sense of self.
So what do you think about that? That suggests, thanks a lot for the call, Joseph. That suggests, you know, America is a complicated place.
Absolutely.
It's not like the American concept of the self.
And I think it's exactly right, as Mbiti points out and as the caller does, African-Americans definitely have a bicultural sense of self. They understand the mainstream autonomous self, but they also know about the interdependent self and the way it's been. Connections with others have been a source of strength and resilience and survival. And many other American groups understand this as well.
Okay, so now you're making me think. Out there are various possibilities offered to me for construing myself. I can think of myself like African Americans. I'm an American. I'm an academic. I'm an intellectual. You know, I mean, how does one of these come to be mine?
Well, the very important point is each of us is very much a multicultural being. So in the course of a day, in the course of a lifetime, we are participating in many, many different cultural contexts. Those are the cultural contexts that come not just from your national origin that we're talking about so far today, but they come from region of the country, they come from race, from religion, from ethnicity, from your profession. They all offer up a set of models of how to be. And of course, what we do as people is we creatively synthesize that into the person we call the self.
So we've got an email here from Mike in Pasadena. He says, are some cultures more autonomous than others? If so, how do we judge cultures as a whole? So let me just follow up a little bit on that. I mean, autonomy is something that philosophers spend a lot of time thinking about, and they assume it's a great value. It's something we ought to encourage in children and students. And autonomy basically means taking responsibility for your own beliefs and desires that motivate your action. So maybe that's not such an important value in other cultures, but is it really a mistake to value autonomy so much?
Well, I think the reason we start always when we're talking about goods in the world with autonomy, because of course we always are thinking first and almost in many contexts only of the Western philosophers, mm-hmm. and of course autonomy was critical to them. Mm-hmm. And I think autonomy is important all over the world. People want to be independent wherever you are. You ask students today about, you know, who are you? They'll say, I want to be my own person. I want to go my own way. But in East Asian context, they will finish with, but I wouldn't do something that would hurt somebody else or would cause problems or troubles for someone else. So from the Western analytical philosophy perspective, we think Descartes, we think I think, therefore I am. From some of these other perspectives, you have to turn that around and say, you think, therefore I am. You know, it's really paying attention to the social in determining who you are. And it is, autonomy is a good, but community is a good. Divinity is a good. There are many other important goods that are out there as well. And in different contexts, we find ways to pay attention to these goods.
So now Johnny in San Francisco asked an interesting question. Might send us off on a tangent, but let's see. Social networking, that seems to have satisfied a hunger that was deep in the American soul. Is that a phenomenon important in understanding how we're kind of adapting our American concept of self to the world in which relationships are available electronically?
Yes, absolutely. It is the case that we are social beings. All of us are interdependent in some very important ways. However, as Americans with our particular philosophical and historical legacy, the one way, the independent way, has been so elaborated, so inscribed throughout history in all of our cultural products. Wherever you look, you see this idea. Driving here this morning, a big billboard that says, "Autonomy dominates," and it's some autonomy is the name of some firm that's out there, some internet site. I mean, we get these messages about the way to be all the time. Now, interdependence is also important, and it is indeed a fact of our being, is less elaborated. I think there is a moment that we are beginning, because there's so much social networking, to actually understand our interdependence.
You know, I don't want to sound like a... Well, yes, I do.
Yes.
Cartesian or something, or Western. But, you know, I think autonomy is a darn good thing. And I don't think it's just one human value among others. I think it's really foundational in some ways. Because, you know what? All these others construing me and demanding and wanting to be this way or that way, that's not about me. That's about them. And I want to acknowledge them, but I want them to acknowledge me in my acknowledging them. And the me, the autonomous, self-respecting, self-governing me, if they don't attend to that, then their construal of me is, well, the heck with it.
That's a very common American way to think. You're a good American, Ken, because you are defining the self, as I started with. You see yourself as this bounded entity. If you can imagine taking the first fact of your philosophy, which would then shape yourself, as that you are in relationship. If you don't take that into account, you are denying an important part of your existence. If you saw yourself as the relational being you really are, that you, if not taking into account the ideas of others, the expectations of others, not always at your own expense, but you have to consider them. You have to adjust to them.
Well, let me draw this part of the conversation to a close with a deep observation rather than a question, which is Americans kind of give and take autonomy, adopt and let go of autonomy depending on convenience, right? I mean, like Republicans, for example, don't think, well, autonomy, that was great for banks till they got in trouble,
exactly.
But now we should all go together as a community and keep the banks out of trouble. However, individual mortgagees that got a little over the head, screw them. With that completely a factual observation, I'll...
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's different cultures, different selves, with Hazel Marcus from Stanford University, one of the world's leading cultural psychologists.
Next, we're going to see how the insights of cultural psychology can be applied to our own lives. Are you trapped in an American self-conception when something more Asian would make you a happier person? And what about the findings of cultural psychology? Do they show that different conceptions are really all equally valid?
Practical lessons from cultural psychology, plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
East is East and West is West. But do these cultural differences mean people inherently see themselves differently? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is noted cultural psychologist Hazel Marcus from Stanford University. And we've got many callers on the line. Tony in Berkeley, welcome to Philosophy Talk. What's your comment or question? Tony's not there. So Hazel, I want to press you a little bit. It seems to me, I'm not sure, that you think that all these different cultural formations of the self are equally valid, right? That one is just as good as another, that one doesn't deserve any higher standing than another. Well, is that right or wrong? Am I misinterpreting you?
Well, as I teach my students, I think we always want to avoid the really slippery slope of complete cultural relativism. I think there is more than one answer to what is a self. I do not think there are an infinite number. It's a finite set and probably a relatively small set of answers to that question. But what I do think, as Americans in American social science, we have stopped with the one answer and has assumed that's the natural human way to be. And so the project of cultural psychology is to say, let's get out there and explore. What are these other answers?
Okay.
Let's.
Okay, I'll take that. Now Tony is back with us. Tony, welcome to Philosophy Talk. Are you there now?
Yeah.
Okay, what's your comment or question?
I just wanted to comment. This is all really interesting. I was wondering if, I'm sure there's been research done on it, but if you could shed any light on the effects of maybe a step-parent who is of another culture on a child who's introduced to that step-parent via the, you know, remarriage or whatever. When I was younger, I moved from Hollywood to the middle of the country on a farm in Wisconsin with a Native American stepfather, and all of our neighbors were Amish, and so that was like a real culture shock, not just in terms of the location, but also, you know, being put into a Native American family, essentially. I spent a lot of time with his family and growing up on a farm for half my life, and so I've just always seen culture as something that's very, or rather the individual within the culture, something that's very malleable, And I just wanted to comment on that.
Okay, Hazel, take it away. Thanks, Tony.
Right, that's an excellent observation. In the case of American Indians, for example, your experience, those models are very much models of interdependence, where a person is seen as part of the community and really has to take the community into account and not focus too much on the self or try to stand out. And if you are just plopped into that without anybody telling you that this is a different way to be, a different way to think and feel, it could really be very discombobulating for a person who comes out of a more mainstream, independent, autonomous self perspective. That's one of the reasons I think it's so important for us to elaborate these various models, get people to understand them. Once they understand them, they can see, oh, I see, this is a somewhat different way of being, different way of thinking about my family, my relatives, and then work with those and see them as resources. But until we bring them out, until we see these cultural ideas and practices that are so much like the water to us, we can absolutely be confused and it can have very bad consequences.
Edie and Hayward's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Edie.
Oh, hi, good morning. I just wanted to agree with Hazel. It's true. More independence is being seen among the Eastern and Latin American families and beings, and Europe and North America are totally thought from the beginning to be individualistic and separate. I came from Mexico in 1986, and I married my husband, a New Yorker, in 1989. And he started kicking all my family out little by little.
Right.
People will show unannounced, or they will just call, and they will just ask and how we were doing and things that we were supposed to be deciding, important things. And little by little, we got isolated because of his style. It was totally individualistic.
Yes, that's also a great observation. If people don't understand that what it means to be a person is to be in relationship, those people are part of you.
Yes.
If they accept you, take you, they take the others that are connected with you.
And he would not understand that. He just thinks it's intrusion and it's rudeness and why they didn't call, what they're doing. He actually kicked my sister married an Iranian and say, why are you doing here?
That's right. And of course, from an interdependent perspective, you can expect people to lean on you, to expect from you, to want from you, and you are obligated to give to them. And of course, it's a reciprocal, so the time will come, maybe not immediately, maybe much later and in some other kind, but you will, of course, return that. That is the nature of being, and it's this one particular individualistic model that has its powerful consequences.
Oh,
don't
yeah.
get me wrong.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for the call, Edie.
Okay, Helen, you've totally convinced me.
It's Hazel.
Hazel.
Oh, what did I call you?
I'm very independent, having an autonomous
self.
Well,
I mean, you know, you're kind of being individualistic there.
I am.
So I'm convinced that my Western individualism is one cultural construct among others. But I'm a little puzzled what I should do about it. As a philosophy professor, I've spent my life encouraging students to think for themselves and to not be bound by the aspirations of their parents in figuring out who they are and what they are and what they should do with their lives. As feminists, I'm sure all three of us push our female students to contemplate roles in life that their cultures, their parents, their ancestors might find totally inappropriate, even shocking for women. Should we give all that up? Should I say, oh, young lady, you're from an Asian family, so you'd best conform to family expectations?
No, absolutely not. Of course, Western civilization owes much of what's good about it to this idea of autonomy, to being an independent self, the very idea of being of free, of managing and of governing yourself and not being dependent on the church, not being dependent on culture or custom, convention, is what's made what's good about the West good. We absolutely need that model. The point is, it's not the only answer.
But I don't quite understand how to reconcile these two thoughts, right? So you have these highly interdependent cultures, cultural constructions of the soul. And interdependent seems like just a fact of human life.
Well, see, that's you understand that now.
Well, I don't think anybody would deny it. Who can do anything? What human being on his or her own can live a life? You need other people to... I mean, there's the division of labor, there's family, there's your children. I mean, I don't think American autonomous culture thinks, right, that we're not connected. It's just that other people can't define us or set the limits of our aspirations or set what we're about without our cooperation and acknowledgement. That's the American thing. You don't get to say who and what I am, right?
Well, not completely, not entirely, but you see, you have the common way of thinking about others' expectations as kind of imprisoning you, that you're trapped in this net. If you thought of others' expectations and obligations as scaffolding, as wind in your sails, that it would you and could think about some of the positive features of it, it would be better for you. It doesn't always make it easy. There's
I don't accept your gloss on what I just said. I think that others can have expectations of me. They can be legitimate expectations,
yes.
But I always have the right and power, this is what autonomy is, to step aside and say, wait a minute, yes or no? If I say yes, then okay, they can define me. If I say no, then they don't. It's up to me ultimately. I mean, so it's not saying that they're a prison, but they need my acknowledgement and endorsement to play any role in constituting me. That's the Western Cartesian, Lockean thought.
That's right. And as I said, there's been tremendous positive consequences from that model and from the elaboration of that model. And we certainly don't want to give it up. What I would say is that I would hope that many Americans who haven't thought about other models besides the model of self as independent, and in fact, America itself, which is so rooted in this idea of independence, would be aware that there are other ways to think and could just take those into account and think about sort of balancing them. So there could be some domains, some situations where you take the others and their ideas into account at least first before you decide.
So I think I see how I can integrate this into my teaching to get back to my question.
Oh, good.
I think I should teach meta-autonomy. That is, in dealing with Americans and in dealing with Americans who maybe have backgrounds where these models are in conflict, we should say, you know, you have a choice to make about the very way you conceive of yourself. The model that you get from America, from American individualism and the Enlightenment, isn't the only one.
Right.
Still, eventually, because you're exposed to these different ones,
yes,
it's up to you.
That's.
But you should be as aware of how these constructs of the self shape your thinking as in philosophy we say you should be aware of how the church or your parents or, you know, something else shapes your thinking.
Absolutely right. And I would say what you should also teach is beyond the Western philosophy, you should expose students to ideas of Confucianism, Buddhism, Taoism, all of these other ideas to help them see the sources of these models. And then very importantly, what you said, John, is the most important important idea, I think, from cultural psychology is not just that we are shaped by these ideas and practices of our cultural context, but we then shape our worlds. We construct our worlds. Our worlds are worlds that we have made. That's a cool thing about being human. We don't just sit around and think. We build worlds according to our ideas and practice. So we do get to choose, and we can build worlds in different ways than the ways we've have built them.
We've got time for one last caller. Muhammad's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Muhammad. I'm not quite sure where you're calling from, but welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yeah. What's your comment or question? You're our last caller.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for taking my call. Well, actually, I am from Pakistan, and I moved here for the last 10 years. And I'm raising my kids over here. We're, the eldest one is 6 and a half, and he's going to American school. So we are also facing this sort of challenge, or I would call it opportunity, that the kind of opportunity that I couldn't get as I was growing up in an autonomous fashion, so having, not having the kind of ability to have my independent thoughts told to others, but I'd like to have sort of a balance in my children's life so that they do value the Asian culture from where we're coming from, as well as have independent thought to be able to succeed in life because of the Western concepts.
Muhammad,
it is a challenge. It is a challenge to do that.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. You got one last comment?
I would just say that I think as humans, we are enormously flexible and inventive and creative. And once we're exposed to these ideas and think about the different ways of being, we can teach even young children that there are different ways to be, and both of them are valuable, and you can learn when to use one and when to use another. It's not always easy. You will find that your children will want to talk back to you and tell you to leave them alone, and they want to have their own life, but you can also get them to appreciate why it's important to think about the family and other connections as well. You just have to draw them out.
Hazel, on that hopeful, optimistic note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks. It's been great. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Hazel Marcus, noted cultural psychologist from Stanford University, editor of Engaging Cultural Differences, The Multicultural Challenge to Liberal Democracy. This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, the blog, philosophytalk.org, or you can also go to our ever-expanding Facebook community. I know some people don't like Facebook, but we got lots and lots of people up there now, and we'd love to have you be a member of our Facebook community.
And you can also download podcasts of our program. Just go to our website and click away according to directions, and you will find yourself in the wonderful world of Philosophy Talk podcasts. For the final word, we're going to turn to a man who straddles the cultural divide like no others, like a colossus, really. Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when it comes to the self, Americans are just weird. We seem to be the most self-conscious people on Earth. I admit I'm not widely traveled, but are the citizens of any other country as concerned about the self as we are? Chinese, Zimbabweans, the French, do they even have words for self-help? Do they have motivational speakers? Do they have a fitness center? Do they worry about personal growth? Can codependence even be found in Iran? What is a role model in Nigeria? We are not only obsessed with ourselves and other people's selves, we are obsessive in our obsessiveness. Give yourself permission to acknowledge that you know or have used any of these terms. Holistic aromatherapy, outreach, ADD, OCD, or seasonal affective disorder. Do space aliens have panic attacks? How many brains do we have? We have left brain, right brain, reptile brain, back brain. Perhaps we are bipolar, symbiotic, dysfunctional, delusional, stressful. That's because we have not found our bliss. We are not empowered. Some borderline types do not respect boundaries. We have not found closure. Oh no, type A personalities are self-medicating. They are acting out. Somebody is enabling their behavior. Could it be passive-aggressive significant others? Intervention. Validate me, you narcissist. I am desensitized. The operative word is overcompensation. I need to be nurtured by a positive feedback loop. No more avoidance. Does any of this resonate with you? Do you have authentic coping mechanisms? Are you conscious or unevolved? You feel me? Certainly, we no longer have complexes or syndromes. Many of us, however, are still anally retentive. We have not found acceptance. We need cleansing, for our mindset is toxic. Our inner child is a repressed brat. We are blocked. We need a hands-on, grounded, proactive approach to nonlinear bioinformatics if you're going to realize your potential and achieve a positive outcome assessment. That's not only part of our personal narrative, it's part of the meta-narrative, not to mention a way to legitimize self-exploration. I have anger management issues. I want a world where every relationship is meaningful, where no self is realized until the self is actualized. I'm talking about self-esteem, a transformative, purposeful self-acceptance. We have fetishized introspection, but maybe we're just hardwired that way. I gotta go.
Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Jennifer Jensen, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.